Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing, our weekly digest of all the news from the super yachting world and an introduction to some of the interesting characters that make it so endlessly fascinating. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and I am joined once again by Caroline White, our Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, Features Director. In a minute, Charlotte will tell you a little more about this week's interviewee, Professor Barry Smith, who will make you think a little deeper about the sensory experience on board your yachts. But before we get to that, we actually saw each other in the flesh yesterday after 6 months of video meetings. It was great to see you both.
Yeah, it was very exciting to actually see your faces in real life. It's been crazy, just 6 months working together every day but haven't actually seen each other.
Yeah, it was nice actually. It kind of reminds you that you can't just do everything digitally. It's nice to, there's no replacement for being in person, I don't think.
That's true. I think I feel on Zoom calls sometimes when you've got, you know, nine talking heads on the screen, everyone's got to take their turn to talk. And live, in the flesh, yeah, you get things done a lot quicker, I think. I'm pretty sure that's the case anyway. But anyway, enough about that. Charlotte, tell us about Barry. How was it?
Yeah, well, look, you'll be able to hear later on the podcast. He's a fascinating guy. So like you said, he's a professor. He's a director at the Institute of Philosophy in London. And he also founded this centre called the Centre for the Study of the Senses. And basically, he'll talk to us a bit about how your senses work when you're on board and how you can sort of tweak your yacht or design a new yacht to make the most of them. But it's really interesting learning more about this kind of thing. I mean, if you're sitting at home, there's a bit of an example of how this works, which is that he was explaining if you rub your hands together normally, they might feel quite kind of soft or normal. And if you do it again with a sort of crackly noise in your headphones when you do it the second time, they'll feel kind of rough and it will be a kind of unpleasant sensation. So it's that sort of thing, that making sure what you can see feels how you would expect it to feel, and that the scent on board matches the textures that you have in your salon, which matches the crockery in terms of how it's interacting with your body. So it's a bit complicated, but really interesting to learn about. And his top tip, if you don't make it the interview, was that he's done a lot of research on private jets and with various aviation companies. And he told me, which I didn't know, that the reason most airplane food tastes pretty disappointing is that your senses are dulled in the sky, but your sense of umami, which is what you would get in mushrooms or things like Parmesan cheese, is heightened. And that's why people love Bloody Marys on flights, because there's tomato juice is an umami flavor. I always had a Bloody Mary on the plane and never any other time. And that's why.
That's a great fact.
Yeah, it's weird. The only time I ever drink a Bloody Mary seems to be on an aeroplane. I honestly can't remember the last time I had one when I wasn't in the air. Actually, I can barely remember the last time I was in the air, having said that. But anyway, Professor Smith, so he sounds like a really interesting guy. So he's like he's an expert in the senses.
Exactly. He has a whole institute looking at how the senses work in different ways, and they do experiments with chefs. And he actually got into it because he's a huge wine connoisseur and he wanted to kind of find out how certain situations affect how you taste wine. And that was another interesting thing talking about flying. He was saying that quite often yacht owners want the same yachts at their homes as they do on their jets, as they do on the yacht. And did you know, if you're on your boat, you want to buy wine that was produced closer to sea level because it will taste better. And if you're in a jet, you want to buy wine that was produced at a high altitude because, again, it does something clever to your senses. It's all very clever stuff. Not all of it I understand, but it's interesting. And I would love to see yacht designers kind of taking this on board a bit, and instead of just going straight for aesthetics and what looks cool, thinking about what kind of feels cool and makes your body feel that something is natural and comfortable in quite a clever way.
So before buying a bunch of wine for your jet or boat, consult Professor Smith.
Exactly. I'm sure he sounds like a guy who knows his wine, regardless of the senses. But yeah, absolutely. He can do some consultancy.
Sounds great. Well, stick around for that interview. That will be coming up very, very shortly. One sign of things returning to normal, Winch Design is reopening after a health and safety consultation. So that big studio in Barnes in London will be going back to work. They have been working, of course, but remotely. So 110 remote offices is consolidating back into one central location.
Yeah, I got that press release too. And I thought it was interesting, not just because it's a sign of people going back to work and studios reopening, but also because I saw they'd launched a Chinese version of its website, but also its own channel on WeChat, which I thought was kind of noteworthy.
And what exactly is WeChat?
Well, from what I know, it's a bit like WhatsApp. It's huge in China, but it's not just for messaging. It's also for payment. So if you go into a restaurant, you look at the menu on WeChat, or you certainly pay on WeChat. It's how the government communicates with kind of Chinese citizens. And from what I understand from people that live out there, everything is done via WeChat. So opening a WeChat channel should make it a lot easier for Chinese clients to speak to Winch directly. And it's kind of the preferred medium over there.
Winch Designs there, making a clever pitch to some Chinese buyers. It's good. I mean, the Chinese market's had its up and downs. We wrote a big feature a couple of years ago. I'm not quite sure what coronavirus has done to the Chinese buyer, but certainly there were signs of life after an anti-corruption drive a while back made conspicuous consumption very, very conspicuous indeed in China. But a couple of years ago at least, there were signs that things were improving. So we'll report on that a bit later in the year when we tally our global order book. We'll see what the appetite over in China is for super yachts. But good luck to Winch Design in their efforts to get a few more Chinese buyers. Another interesting conversation we had the other day was with Sajeev Chahil. So Sajeev is a marketing guru from Silicon Valley. He's worked with the likes of Apple, and Hewlett Packard, I think, is also on his CV. But anyway, he's a very well-known and very, very connected guy over there. And he is actually going to be one of our headline speakers at next year's Super Yacht Design Festival.
Yeah, it was an interesting chat with him. One of the things I thought was quite cool was he was talking about Tesla over in Silicon Valley and the fact that even though they're kind of, for a lot of people, prohibitively expensive, once people test drive them or once people know relatives and friends that have them, they give them a try and they can't help but buy them. And I was kind of wondering, is there a sort of Tesla equivalent in the super yacht world? Someone who's a bit of an outsider, who's designing something really sleek and beautiful, who might be about to sort of turn the world on its head?
Well, I mean, the holy grail for that is kind of, massive yachts carry large battery banks, but they also need generators to charge them. So there's obviously still combustion happening on board to charge the batteries. But in the tender market, there's a bit more opportunity for all electric, no combustion operations. So there's a guy called Conrad Bergstrom, which is an incredibly enigmatic guy.
The X-Shore boats kind of stole the show a bit at Monaco last year, or at least certainly the tenders bit. I had a little trip on one without even knowing much about it, just because they look so cool. You know, there was this whole lineup of little electric boats, but that was the one that everyone was kind of oohing and aah over. And a bit like when Apple first did the iPod, it just kind of has this amazing, iconic branding. It's instantly recognizable and looks very sort of fresh compared to a lot of the other ones.
I'm not quite sure what the take-up amongst the super yacht buying community has been for these electric tenders. We'll have to wait and see. But good luck to Conrad and his effort to electrify the tender market. Talking about cool boats, cool designs, I don't know if you guys saw FedShip have launched a new concept. So it's a great-looking boat designed by DeVoit. I'm not entirely convinced about the name. However, it's called Project FG, which means Freddy Gump. So it's 109-meter long concept, and the thinking behind it was to combine rock star level partying with down to earth innovative design. And the two characters they thought that embodied those two concepts were Freddie Mercury and Forrest Gump, slightly bizarrely. So they combined those two names and came up with Project FG or Freddie Gump.
I'd be interested to see what that looks like. I haven't seen it yet, but kind of rock stars and down to earth tend to not really go together anyway. I think that's a strange brief for any designer to have to carry out.
Yeah, I can see the rock star side of it. Freddie Mercury, I'm following the logic there, but I think the Forrest Gump element is where they maybe have gone slightly off-piste.
I'm not sure Gump's a very super yachty word. And I'm sure if you got that boat built and your friends found out that it was originally called Project Freddy Gump, you'd be endlessly ribbed about your boat being like a box of chocolates now.
You'd certainly be in line for a bit of a teasing, I reckon.
we'll have to see. Isn't Forrest Mercury a much cooler name? Shouldn't it be Forrest Mercury?
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes.
It'd be interesting to see the thinking behind that from the FedShip marketing team. But besides the name, beautiful concept.
Also, we are talking about it now, so it's worked.
Yeah, good point, well made.
Yeah, absolutely. In other news, if you'll permit us, the October issue, the biggest issue of the year of Boat International, is on sale this week. And on the cover, a massive exclusive, we have IJ, the big 108-metre Benetti, or IJE. It's three initials joined together. I'm not sure if people call it IJ or IJE. I don't know. I'll have to ask Benetti. But we've called it on the cover anyway, the world's most elegant explorer. And she's an absolute stunner, featuring design inside and out by British studio RWD. And you know it's an RWD boat because she's got these really elegant drooping fashion plates between the decks. It's a bit of a signature of the studio. You've seen them before on boats like Varvar 2 and 65-metre Rahil. So the brief for this boat was for an explorer of extreme elegance that can carry three large tenders. That was basically it. So most boats are designed from the outside in. So a designer will define the general arrangement, which will dictate length and volume, which in turn informs the exterior styling. But IJE turned that completely on its head. The exterior came first. So the envelope came first. And then the studio and the shipyard had to figure out how to pack in all the things the owner wanted. Like, there's a very cool nightclub, huge tender garage, massive gym. It's an awesome spaces on board. But it's just an interesting deviation from the norm. So the styling, the exterior styling came first.
So how does she compare to the other big Benetti launches recently, which are about the same size?
Yeah, they're all about the same size. So Benetti had a big 2019 and 20, three big boats hitting the water, over 100 metres. So IJ is 108 metres long, making her Benetti's flagship by length, and she carries a gross tonnage of 3,367. So luminosity, which was also on the cover of Boat International recently, is 40 centimetres shorter at 107.6 metres long, but she has a gross tonnage of 5,844, so a massively more voluminous boat. So it just goes to show you that, IJE owner could have had masses of more volume, but he really wanted the sleek, cool styling first, whereas the luminosity owner really wanted a hell of a lot more volume packed into his platform. Another big feature in the magazine is an interview with design guru Terry Disdale. So he opened his doors to his stunning Thames side home. And Charlotte, you wrote that one. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's a lovely house. Very cool, as you'd expect. Sort of Terry and Daniela showed us round that you can see a lot of Asian and African influences. So they've got lots of African art and lots of sort of interesting things they've collected on their travel. It kind of shows they're permanently traveling and looking for things, and their house is really a little collection of all these treasures. And what was interesting about the house, which I think lots of people don't do enough, is that they've just completely reshaped it to suit their lifestyle. So, for example, they'd had quite a big kitchen before and they found they weren't really using it. So they'd chop things about a bit to change it for a very big space where they could have friends for entertaining, or things like Terry is a huge fishing obsessive, which I didn't know before this. So he's got his own little room, which is just totally dedicated to fishing, and his collection of antique fishing rods and his little kind of cubby hole that he enjoys. So it's a very personalized space while being very beautiful as well. And the other thing I wasn't expecting was I didn't realize they have two little dogs, and the dogs have their own wardrobe. So even the dogs have their own space. And if you look in the article, you can see the little dogs. So it's not really a house for two, it's a house for four. They talked about the dogs a lot and how the house kind of worked for, they've got lots of beautiful grounds, and you can see them scampering about outside. But it's a beautiful place, and it's sort of what you'd expect from his previous work, but a bit different as well.
Yeah, some of the artwork was really special, wasn't it? I mean, and sourced from all over the place. It's a real real collection there.
Yeah, and you can also see that if people are sort of interested in the grounds a bit, you can catch that in, I know that we mentioned it previously, that you interviewed Terry Disdale and Tim Haywood and Andrew Winch, these kind of three design legends. And that video is going to be going up on our virtual boat show soon. So that was filmed at Terry's house. So poor Terry, I feel like he's hosted us so many times. He's going to have to set up a tent in the garden sometime soon, or they'll ask us to leave.
Terry and Daniel laid on some very nice sandwiches the day we did the video interview.
What so, nice people. Patient and kind, yeah.
But it was a great day. So we've finally done the edit of that video. It's a hell of a thing. So that will be going up shortly, and we'll obviously keep you posted about that. There's lots of other stuff in the October issue, of course. There's an insight into crew salaries, We talk about The Secret of Below Deck Success, the TV show taken, the world by storm. It took a lot while, few seasons to get to the UK, but it was a massive following in the US and building rapidly in the UK and elsewhere. So we talked to some of the key characters behind the show. We reveal also the interiors of the legendary 85-meter Lursen Ace. That's a winch interior, actually. So that is a really special boat. So that's never been seen before. So that's in the issue. We have a biannual design report. We have a feature about your favourite boat, Charlotte. Spirit 111, guys.
It's the one I'm always banging on about. People can finally see why.
Yeah, well, it's just, absolutely really special project. And of course, there's loads more. So go out and buy it. There you go. Caroline, talk us through the new launches.
We got a glimpse of Royal Houseman's Project 404, a 60-metre sailor that emerged from her shed for the first time for the turning of her aluminium hull, which is always an amazing thing to see anyway. We know that she was built for the race circuit, so she'll have a carbon composite superstructure, a lifting keel, retractable propulsion, and twin carbon rudders. So we know that anyway, but from these images, we could also see that she has a beautiful reverse bow, a flush deck, massive portholes, and a really broad transom leading into a beach club, which is very exciting.
So it's a Malcolm McKeon boat, isn't she? Malcolm designed her. And I don't think there's any designer in the world who does a cooler, sleeker sailing yacht than Malcolm McKeon. I'm really looking forward to seeing her in the water.
I absolutely agree. So she's due for delivery in 2022. So we've got a little while to wait, but we'll definitely be keeping an eye on that one. And then we also have Cantieri Della Marche's first Flexplorer, which is something I believe we've mentioned before on this podcast, but it's such a cool boat. We've been keeping an eye on that one. The first hull is called Aurelia. It's 40 metres and it has everything you'd expect for an expedition yacht, as well as some pretty cool details such as the collapsible aft deck bulwarks, which fold out so you can create a sort of infinity deck, an industrial-inspired decor, which we've discussed before, and a wine cellar, which I think is particularly cool.
There's a really cool A-frame on the back as well, kind of folds out of the flush deck for, really easy tender launching as well. So it's kind of like that combination of slightly industrial applications on a super yacht. So I can't wait to see that in practice as well. In fact, if it's on the water, it would be great to see if we can get on here fairly soon.
Yeah, no, I'm harassing the yard as we speak for photographs, don't worry. Then we've also got the first San Lorenzo 44 alloy has been delivered as well. That's an all aluminium 44.5 metre named H1. And a highlight of that one is the 145 square metre master suite, which is split across three levels with both indoor and outdoor areas. So I look forward to seeing a bit more of that boat. Nauta Swan has added a new model to its Club Swan range. The Club Swan 80 is a 24 metre and it's inbuilt at Persico Marine in Italy. The idea was to create a yacht for real-time racing, end quotes, to have a load of identical yachts that were modern, fast, fun to compete, and at the same time had equivalent features that relied on the owner's abilities at the helm. So really showing the person behind the boat, really.
Yeah, this thing looks like an absolute weapon. When are we going to see the first one?
So Swan say that the first hull will be debuting at the Maxi Rolex Cup in 2022.
Looking forward to seeing her there. So we've also been digging through some boat pro statistics for this week's podcast because we've been hearing anecdotally, at least, about more yachts in certain territories than others. And obviously, given lockdown, it's been a slightly interrupted cruising season for many people. So Caroline, you've been looking a bit further into this. Can you tell us about, so what have you discovered in your investigations?
Well, we looked at Boat Pro's AIS system to see exactly where boats have been going this summer. So from the 1st of May to the end of August this year, compared to the same period last year, this is what we saw. The traditional summer destinations of Italy, the Balearics, the south of France, Greece, they were all down between 15 and 20% compared to last year over the summer months. Croatia, by contrast, was up an average of 18% over that period. And taking June in particular, that was up 34% compared to the same month last year.
I'm really pleased to see Croatia getting a lot more yachts going over there. I went last year to Rovinj to have a look at the new marina there, which they put so much money into. And there's a huge hotel running along the front called Grand Park Hotel. But it's so beautiful around there. The waters are amazing. The kind of little cobbled towns are beautiful. And inland, in the sort of countryside, it was really bucolic and beautiful. So I've always felt like it was a bit kind of, you know, yacht owners do talk about it, but it maybe doesn't get quite the recognition it deserves. So I really hope this lasts.
Well, I hope so too. It sounds like there's been a lot more people discovering Croatia this year, up 34% in June.
That's massive. Incredible.
Yeah. Well, at the time, they were one of the few countries even open to foreign visitors. So it's kind of understandable. But yeah, lots more people discovering Croatia this year.
Yes, exactly. I'm sure the month-to-month fluctuations in the numbers will be down to restrictions changing between countries. I'm sure that's at least part of the story there.
So given that, the fact that, you know, a lot of US boats didn't come over the Med to the Med this year, so how was it in home waters in the US? How was Florida and the Bahamas and territories like that?
Well, interestingly, Florida was up an average of 42% over the period that we're discussing. Perhaps that is, as you say, a consequence of American boats not making their usual move across to Europe for the summer and owners using their boats closer to home. Similarly, the Caribbean was up 38% over that period, perhaps for the same reason, but it could also be because owners and charterers have been favouring more remote beach-type holidays over Med holidays that are packed with bars and restaurants and socialising. And if our listeners have any other theories, we'd love to hear from you.
So, yeah, some really interesting statistics there. So that's all about boat movement. So the traditional areas in the Med, down Italy, Balearic, south of France, Greece, down 15% and 20% in boat traffic. Croatia way up, Florida way up, and the Caribbean way up over the traditional slow season for them. So that's, yeah, fascinating stuff. So that's all data derived from Boat Pro, which is a hell of a tool if you're looking for a bit of insight into the superyacht market. I highly recommend checking it out. So that's about it for the news this month. I hope you found that interesting. So Charlotte's interview with Barry Smith will be on very shortly. But from us, see you next time.
As many boat regulars will know, each year the Superyacht Design Symposium takes place in the Dolomite Mountains in Italy. It's a huge industry gathering of designers and owners, shipyards and various specialists that starts the year off with a bang. And often, while we're researching new topics and new experts that might want to join us on stage, we come across some really fascinating people. Professor Barry Smith is here with us today, and a true case in point. Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
So you're a man who wears many hats. Recently, I know you've been busy working on the COVID symptoms, loss of smell and taste, and kind of getting that officially recognised, very topical. You're a professor of philosophy at the University of London, but you also founded a very special institution, didn't you? The Centre for the Study of Senses. So how on earth did you get there? Let's start with that, shall we?
Yes. Well, as a philosopher, I was working on perception, and we're always trying to figure out how our senses take in information from the world around us and put us in touch with our environment and even in touch with our own bodies. And my particular interest was working on taste. And I had an amateur interest in wine. I was writing a little bit for the wine press. And here I am telling people how things taste. And I thought, I better find out how tasting works. So when I talked to my colleagues in neuroscience, they said, oh, it's very complicated. Always involves touch, taste, and smell. And they told me two things that I thought were fascinating. One, that we've got way more senses than five, maybe as many as 22 or 33. Wow. And then secondly, they told me that the senses don't work independently of one another. They tend to have a lot of crosstalk. They affect each other's workings. And so for that reason, I thought everything we've thought up till now is wrong. I started a center and I brought psychologists and neuroscientists and philosophers together to figure out how the senses really work, how they shape experience, and to do some experiments. And we opened a lab.
So really, you just loved wine, and that's how you ended up starting an entire institution.
Isn't that great? It's a great story. A love of wine that took me into sort of deepest connections with neuroscience and sensory research, yes.
Fair enough. Well, studying the senses, kind of, I know you've been focusing a lot on how they interact with each other. Is that a relatively new way of looking at the senses, or you know, since Roman times have people been looking at that?
very few people knew that the senses were so interactive. There had been one or two pioneers, usually in the 19th century, who'd figured this out. But you know, nowadays, the connections are surprising. There are odors in shampoo that make your hair feel softer. The things that you see visually can affect what you hear, and what you see can be affected by what you touch. So this way of looking at sensory interrelation gives you a lot of strange and funny phenomena. I mean, one of my favorites is if you rub your hands together, they might feel nice and soft. Then I pop a pair of headphones on, like the sort you're wearing. And as you rub your hands, I give you this crackling sound. And now your hands will feel as dry as parchment, as if they've somehow got this, you know, horrible rough and coarseness to them. And what that shows, I think, is that the brain is taking in all sorts of information at the same time from many senses, and it's trying to put them together and make best sense of what's going on out there.
That's fascinating. And we have some little experiments at home after the podcast. So what does your day job look like? I know that you're based up in Scotland, aren't you? Do you travel? What kind of clients do you work with?
I'm actually based in London.
Ah!
Being a professor at the University of London, I would love to be in Scotland if they would. Maybe I can now under the new remote working situation, but usually it's in London. I'm in Senate House in central London at the back of the British Museum. And our days are usually filled with seeing students, lots of meetings with colleagues. But we have in the institute, we have a lovely open plan working environment where we can talk to one another. And the great fun is designing experiments, working out how to do the next experiment, figuring out how the senses might be working, and then setting it up and asking people to come into the lab and doing the testing. Luckily, I don't have to do much of that. I have lots of lovely juniors who do that for me. But then we spend hours analyzing the results and trying to figure things out. And those days are good. But one of the things that we really like doing is finding out what's the translation between what we can achieve and find in the lab, and how does that work in the world? I mean, when we try to scale up, will things work the same way in the raw, in the natural environment as they work mm-hmm. in these very controlled settings? And quite often we are lucky enough to get into museums and galleries or to appear at festivals. And there we can take our equipment and our kit and our tricks and show people things where they can discover facts about their own senses that are often quite astonishing to them.
Fabulous. So I imagine at this stage, this all sounds very fascinating, very academic, and people listening might think, what on earth has this got to do with my super yacht? How does this sort of thing and the sort of research you're doing, how does that tie into life on board?
Well, I think life on board is like all other experiences, very multi-sensory. You've got motion, of course. You've got the sound of the engines. You've got the look and the feel of all the surfaces inside the boat. And people tend to forget that because the senses are working together, these different sensory inputs will have an effect on one another. And when I've talked to designers, they've been very interested in the way in which our ability to deal with our environment is better when the sensory information is congruent, when it goes together, when things seem to be harmonious and match. Mm. And you not only are you having sounds and sights and the rocking motion, but you're also, of course, getting smell. There's the smell of the sea and the smell of particular harbors, as boat owners will know. And all of these things are having an impact on your mood, your moment-to-moment experience of the world, and your expectations, your anticipation of what comes next.
So basically, and I know that you'll be talking about this at the Super Yacht Design Festival, you can design a boat based entirely around what's going to be a real festival for the senses and what's going to give you an incredible experience all the time on board.
Yes, I think people have often been very preoccupied with how things look. And yeah, they haven't always realized that there's how they sound, there's how they feel, and whether the feel of them matches the look of them. I mean, we get cues about texture of wood or stone or surfaces from our eyes. And if we put our fingers down and you get a mismatch between what your eyes were telling you and what your fingers feel, that's rather uncomfortable. It's almost disturbing. Whereas if you can make things that not only work together well, but if you can give nice sensory cues where the brain's expecting something to happen and it does happen, you get an extra boost and reward for that. And it can make you feel very comfortable.
And what are the, I mean, I think most owners will know, oh, I hate it when I can hear that engine noise, or I don't like it when I'm sunbathing with my guests and the smells from the open galley are wafting down. Are there any sort of things that people might not know that are affecting their senses and might be kind of lessening their enjoyment?
Yes, this comes from a piece of work I did with Heesen Yachts. Heesen were launching their new boat, their Supernova boat, and the proud boast was that having two engines, they had a silent engine, as they called it. They, for slow sailing, they had a much quieter engine. And they contacted me because they'd seen a piece of research I did with colleagues about the effect of noise in your ears when you're flying. So it turns out that the noise of the engines droning on, 89 decibels or above, actually impacts on your ability to taste what you're eating and can reduce salt, sweet, and sour by about 10 to 15%. Now, this is why when you're flying, if you want the food to taste better, take some noise-canceling headphones or one basic taste that's not affected by the noise interference is umami. Now, umami is the fifth basic taste along with salt, sweet, sour, and bitter. And it's the taste of soy sauce or mushrooms, Parmesan cheese. Mm. What gives you lots of umami that you can find on an aircraft? And the answer is tomatoes, and in particular, tomato juice. And people drink tomato juice, often a Bloody Mary on a plane, and at no other time. And we managed to find out that's why it tastes much, much better. So having done this research on the effects of sound on our enjoyment of food and the environment, Heesen wanted me to talk about this and to talk about the chance of sailing in or out of harbor, slow sailing with the more silent engine, and that this would actually give you less interference. You'd be able to be much more aware of the sounds around you, the sound of the sea. You'd also be able to concentrate more on the fabulous food that was being cooked for you. So when Heesen approached me and wanted me to come to the Monaco yacht show and to talk about this at their opening, I said, well, the first thing you have to tell me is how noisy is this engine? And they looked at the specs and they said 49 decibels. And I said, ah, that's the sound of gently falling rain. So that's rather pleasant. That's not going to interfere with our enjoyment of other things around us. So I was able to talk to a lot of super yacht journalists about this and to designers. And it was a strange thing for me to be experiencing their concerns in their world, but how integrated with mine, and that they suddenly became aware that maybe there are lots of sensory cues that we have to pay attention to. And that's what I'm hoping to talk to you about at the boat conference.
And is there something that, you know, it must have been quite strange for you working with a superyacht company? It's a bit different to your day to day. Is this something you think superyacht designers and your owners are going to increasingly be saying, okay, well, instead of, you know, what line do I want on my boat? They're saying, I really want to enjoy my breakfast on this deck. What do I need to tweak for the senses to make it work?
Yes, I do think that. I mean, it's following a trend from architects, and of course, naval architects are no different. If you're thinking about the space that we inhabit, an architect once said to me that buildings are spaces that house memories. And I think that's very good. And you want that to, you want those experiences to be enjoyable, but memorable. We want them to have an impact on us. And I'm always trying to remind people that when they visit stores or galleries or concert halls, that they know there's a particular smell they have. When you go into a particular gallery you love, instantly it's recognizable. And that has an impact on you. That can calm you, soothe you. It's very familiar when you return to it. So there are many features about a space, an enclosed space, that are all about working in tandem with our senses and our senses responding to them. And if you get that right, those are the spaces we love to be in and we have our best experiences in.
It's interesting you mention fragrance on board, because I spoke to a company a couple of years ago. I know so many people have their kind of signature yacht scent, which might be the same fragrance they have in their home and their holiday homes and that sort of thing. But there are also these people now doing more kind of complex different scents for different spaces. So you might have the same base notes, and then in your office it's something slightly different, and in the galley it's the salon or the cabin it's something, you know, the same scent but tweaked slightly to give you a different feeling. And it's incredible how all these little touches can add up, like you say, when they play into other elements to you know, to give you a sense of feeling at home or relaxed or whatever it might be. Yeah, you mentioned jets earlier, and I'm interested because you've obviously done work in the aviation space as well. Who do you think is more far ahead in this? The sort of private jet companies or the super yacht builders? Is one of them much better than the other at sort of playing up to these things?
I think the private jet companies and indeed the builders of commercial aircraft are thinking on a very long time scale. They're trying to envisage what will flight be like in 2050. And that was before the coronavirus. It may end up being very different. But they were often trying to be incredibly novel, but not necessarily thinking about the experience of the passenger. I talked to aircraft manufacturer Embraer, who were talking about, wouldn't it be wonderful for enjoying the pleasure of your surroundings if while you are flying, the cabin could become transparent and you could see the landscape below you. And I said, well, I think you have to worry about people's fear of heights at that level and think, you know, maybe people don't want to see the land below them. Out the window, yes, but maybe not completely. Whereas if you're on a yacht, you can imagine, and we know that many super yachts have done this, they can have inspection chambers with glass where you can look into the depths, or you can plunge down to look at them if you've got a little remote on board. So you've got to think of the environment, and you've got to think of the human in that environment. And multisensory experience is all about the factors that will shape that experience. And they've got to be right for you, and they've got to be right in the context.
And are there any sort of, if you're an owner listening and you're thinking, well, I'm not going to rebuild my whole boat based on how my senses work, are there any sort of quick wins? You've obviously got fragrance and sort of cutting down on noise. You mentioned earlier sort of making sure that textures match what you're expecting them to feel like. Are there things people can do on board to make the things better sort of instantly?
Yes, I mean, I think texture is very important. It's funny that we're used to often eating at lovely wooden tables, because the feel of wood under our fingers gives us something of a grain, but at the same time, smoothness. And we know, again, from our senses that if you're eating ice cream and I give you velvet to rub at the same time, the ice cream will be very creamy and smooth and soft. And if I give you Velcro to rub, it'll seem rather coarse and rough. So there's a prediction that the brain does from how you feel things in your fingers to how you have them in your tongue, because these are two fingertips and tongue, very sensitive in the body. So the feel of things, the feel of the weight of the cutlery, the feel of the table that you're at, and of course, colors. You've gone to a great deal of thought and expense to equip your yacht. Think about the crockery and cutlery and the plates that you put in there too. Not just that they're super designed, but it turns out that people gain more pleasure and more intensity of taste eating off a round white plate. Who knew?
Really?
Yes. there are funny things about even plating food. One of my favorite things is that a lot of chefs tried to do something very novel, which is asymmetric plating. So all the food is on the right-hand side of the plate, nothing on the left. It looks remarkable, but we did a lot of online experiments where we showed people pictures of food and they had to say which they preferred. And we even had a way of asking people how much they were willing to pay. And it turns out people hate asymmetric plating. They would pay more to have the food in the middle of the plate. So these are small things, but they're things that show that everyday aesthetics matter. You choose your favorite mug, you like this spoon.
Yeah.
Things that just give you that feeling of right. They're right in the setting. They feel right. They look right. They're comforting. So I think a lot of thought about decor has to work that way. Don't be dramatic unless you're prepared to compensate for it elsewhere. And again, sounds really matter. The soundscape matters. Modern day luxury hotels quite often have very faint scent in their air conditioning. And some of the hotels I've loved most, I've walked into, and the moment I walk into them, I feel relaxed and soothed and happy. And I wonder, why is that? And I remember asking one particular hotel, have you got some lavender pulsing in the air conditioning? And they said, yes. Now, the beauty of it is it must be at such a low level that you almost don't notice. That's when it's effective. And also it has to pulse, because if you have it constantly, the brain gets used to it and simply turns off. So you need these. So there are a few things you can do. And lovely smell of lavender as you go to sleep probably soothe you enormously, I think.
And if I was designing the sort of dream super yacht bar, you know, the standard is to have aluminium and things like that. Is that how you would go about it? Or would you be thinking of velvet and sort of what I would consider to be a kind of crazy look for this sort of thing?
I would think of things that were dark. I think of woods. I think of leather. Because quite often the colors are provided by the bottles. A lot of work went into those labels and designs. And as you look at a gantry, you know, there's a huge amount of stuff. But if it's clashing with high contrast surfaces like steels and aluminium, you may miss a lot of the features. And I think that's, we think of an old-fashioned cocktail bar. We think of low lighting, leather chairs, wooden top table. And then it's, as you mute everything else that your senses are being bombarded with, that allows what you're concentrating on, the cocktail, the drink, to speak loudest. So it's often an interplay between the senses where you can tone down one to accentuate the other.
That's very interesting. So you're trying to, like you say, you're trying to balance what it is that you're doing to get the most out of what's the most important. Let's talk a bit about art, something else that I know a lot of owners are interested in. And in particular, I know that I know a few people that collect this artist. You've worked on a project with Ólafur Eliasson, hope I'm saying that right, the Icelandic artist who I know has done some wonderful things. Can you tell us a bit about what you did with them?
Yes, I was invited to go to a wonderful sensory workshop that Ólafur and colleagues put on in his studio in Berlin. It was a 2.5-day event. There were thinkers, artists, designers, scientists all brought together to look at how we might not just create experiences, but offer opportunities to reflect on them. And what I particularly like to do when I'm working with artists or galleries or museums, I like to create something that's between an experience and an experiment, where people enjoy doing it, but they can also contribute to the science, where their responses can give us information that we can then use to create even better experiences in future. And Ólafur asked me whether at the beginning of the workshop, as everyone arrives, and they don't all know each other, 30 of us, actually even more, I think about 50 of us, how are we going to break the ice? And he decided that he would start the whole workshop with a multi-sensory dinner, and that we would sit around the table. And his sister is, in fact, a trained chef. And in his studio on the top floor, they have a wonderful dining space and a fully equipped kitchen. So she and I and colleagues designed a dinner where people could explore what was happening in their senses, how the sounds that were presented to them would affect how things tasted, how they could contrast textures, how they could make things smoother or rougher with the wine by feeling soft and rough surfaces. And this became a talking point. People would talk to their neighbors, they would share their experiences, they would talk about it. So it was a wonderful way of exploring ourselves, sharing that with others, and then opening us up to new possibilities as we went into the workshop. And when Ólafur was putting on his exhibition, his recent exhibition, his retrospective Real Life with mm-hmm. Great. He did an interview with me for the catalogue, and as he was talking about my work, he said, I like what you're doing because you're part of the counter numbness movement. I thought, wow, what's that? And he said, well,
a compliment.
It's great. And I thought, I want the t-shirt, counter numbness. Yeah. But what he said was, you know, you're reminding people to use their senses, to use taste and smell and touch, to you're reminding them how to get more out of their experience and pay attention to what's going on in them, because we mainly sit as now behind screens with audiovisual equipment, and we forget many more things are affecting our senses. So he thought it was a good idea to find new ways to get out there and to democratize that, in fact, to remind more and more people they can have experiences with their senses that are not just audiovisual.
I think that's a very good point. And I think too often we sort of concentrate on blocking things out, you know, reducing noise, reducing light, reducing whatever. But actually, you know, there are things you can do that sort of enliven you and waken you up, and you enjoy the world in a whole new way. So it's fascinating stuff. And I can't wait to see what you do on boats. Back to the wine. Are you going to do a super yacht wine cellar anytime soon?
I'd be very happy to do that. I did some work on wines in the sky. And here's an interesting fact, that some of the wines that taste best at high altitude are not the ones that taste best on the ground. So when...
Really?
Yes, when British Airways were doing a little experiment and they had people tasting a lot of wines in the lounge and then tasting them on a flight after 2 hours, after 4 hours, a wine which had been okay in the lounge but wasn't necessarily the favorite, it was a wine by Nicholas Catena, and it was his high altitude Malbec. And when it was tasted at 35,000 feet, it tasted superb. It just sang. So I said to the British Airways wine buyer, well, what's the cabin pressure at 35,000 feet? He said, well, it probably could be around 5,500 feet is the internal pressure. And I said, that's interesting, because this wine, Angelica Zapata, is made at 5,000 feet on the side of the Andes.
So wow.
That's it at its best. That's where it's supposed to be drunk, to find it most balanced. And another, not Catena, but another Malbec winemaker told me that he thought he'd sold so much wine to Lufthansa, he thought he was going into travel, and he sold a lot of his wine to a cruise company, and it didn't work. Of course, it was at sea level. So maybe even the altitude of the wines you have to be right for the environment you're in. So maybe I need to reverse things and think of, and perhaps it's a good idea to do a proper controlled tasting in the lounge and at sea, and we'll find out which things drink best.
I think that's a fabulous point to end with. If you're planning an amazing adventure, make sure you don't take the same wine on your yacht as on your jet, because on one of those, it won't be very good. Well, thank you so much, Barry. It's been fascinating talking to you, and really looking forward to hearing more from you in Cortina. Enjoy the rest of the week.
Thank you. Looking forward to seeing everyone in Cortina.
Thanks for that, Charlotte. Some fascinating insights there from Professor Smith. But that's it from Boat Briefing this week. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week. Have a great one.